repeating, nodding discreetly at the bedside. She spoke to Uwe as if Sonya were not even in the room. Admittedly, Uwe opened the door this time, but she was ejected all the same. "The only home we're going to is our own, where we live," Uwe roared at her, and in pure frustration and anger he threw one of Sonya's shoes out of the room. Afterwards, he had to go and ask the nurses, who'd almost been hit by it, if they knew where it had gone. Which, of course, made him even angrier. It was the first time since the accident that he heard Sonya laughing, as if it was pouring out of her without the slightest possibility of stopping it, like she was being wrestled to the ground by her own giggling. She laughed and laughed and laughed until the vowels were rolling across the walls and floors, as if they meant to do away with the laws of time and space. It made Uwe feel as if his chest was slowly rising out of the ruins of a collapsed house after an earthquake. It gave his heart space to beat again. He went home and rebuilt the whole house, ripped out the old countertop and put in a new, lower one, even managed to find a specially made stove, reconstructed the door frames and fitted ramps all over the thresholds. The day after Sonya was allowed to leave the hospital, she went back to her teacher training. In the spring, she sat her examination. There was an advertisement in the newspaper for a teaching position in a school with the worst reputation in town, with the sort of class that no qualified teacher with all the parts of her brain correctly screwed together would voluntarily face. It was attention deficit hyperactivity disorder before attention deficit hyperactivity disorder had been invented. "There's no hope for these boys and girls," the headmaster soberly explained in the interview. "This is not education, this is storage." Maybe Sonya understood how it felt to be described as such. The vacant position attracted only one applicant, and she got those boys and girls to read Shakespeare. In the meantime, Uwe was so weighed down with anger that Sonya sometimes had to ask him to go outside so he didn't demolish the furniture. It pained her infinitely to see his shoulders so loaded down with the will to destroy that bus driver, the travel agency, the crash barrier of that highway, the wine producer, everything and everyone. Punch and keep punching until every bastard had been obliterated. That was all he wanted to do. He put that anger in his shed. He put it in the garage. He spread it over the ground during his inspection rounds. But that wasn't all. In the end, he also started putting it in letters. He wrote to the Spanish government, to the Swedish authorities, to the police, to the court, but no one took responsibility. No one cared. They answered by reference to legal texts or other authorities, made excuses. When the council refused to build a ramp at the stairs of the school where Sonya worked, Uwe wrote letters and complaints for months. He wrote letters to newspapers. He tried to sue the council. He literally inundated them with the unfathomable vengefulness of a father who had been robbed. But everywhere, sooner or later, he was stopped by men in white shirts with strict, smug expressions on their faces. And one couldn't fight them. Not only did they have the state on their side, they were the state. The last complaint was rejected. The fighting was over because the white shirts had decided so. And Uwe never forgave them that. Sonya saw everything. She understood where he was hurting, so she let him be angry, let all that anger find its outlet somewhere and some way. But on one of those early summer evenings in May that always come along bearing gentle promises about the summer ahead, she rolled up to him, the wheels leaving soft marks on the parquet floor. He was sitting at the kitchen table, writing one of his letters, and she took his pen away from him, slipped her hand into his, and pressed her finger into his rough palm, leaned her forehead tenderly against his chest. "That's enough, Uwe, no more letters. There's no space for life with all these letters of yours." And she looked up, softly caressed his cheek, and smiled. "It's enough now, my darling Uwe." And then it was enough. The next morning, Uwe got up at dawn, drove the Saab to her school, and with his own bare hands built the disabled ramp the council was refusing to put up. And after that, she came home every evening for as long as Uwe could remember, and told him, with fire in her eyes, about her boys and girls, the ones who arrived in the classroom with police escorts, yet when they left, could recite 400-year-old poetry. The ones who could make her cry and laugh and sing until her voice was bouncing off the ceilings of their little house. Uwe could never make head nor tail of those impossible kids, but he was not beyond liking them for what they did to Sonia. Every human being needs to know what she's fighting for. That was what they said. And she fought for what was good. For the children she never had. And Uwe fought for her. Because that was the only thing in this world he really knew. Chapter 24. A man called Uwe and a brat who draws in color. The Saab is so full of people when Uwe drives away from the hospital that he keeps checking the fuel gauge as if he's afraid that it's going to break into a scornful dance. In his rearview mirror, he sees Parvana unconcernedly giving the 3-year-old paper and color crayons.
"Does she have to do that in the car?" barks Uwe.
"Would you rather have her restless, so she starts wondering how to pull the upholstery off of the seats?" Parvana says calmly.
Uwe doesn't answer, just looks at the 3-year-old in his mirror. She's shaking a big purple crayon at the cat in Parvana's lap and yelling,
"Drawing!"
The cat observes the child with great caution, clearly reluctant to make itself available as a decorative surface. Patrick sits between them, turning and twisting his body to try to find a comfortable position for his leg cast, which he's wedged up on the armrest between the front seats. It's not easy because he's doing his best not to dislodge the newspapers that Uwe has placed both on his seat and under the cast. The 3-year-old drops a colored crayon which rolls forward under the front passenger seat where Jimmy is sitting. In what must surely be a move worthy of an Olympian acrobat for a man of his physique, Jimmy manages to bend forward and scoop up the crayon from the mat in front of him. He checks it out for a moment, grins, then turns to Patrick's propped-up leg and draws a large, smiling man on the cast. The toddler shrieks with joy when she notices.
"So you're going to start making a mess as well?" says Uwe.
"Pretty neat, isn't it?"
Jimmy crows and looks as if he's about to make a high five at Uwe. Uwe rolls his eyes.
"Sorry, man, couldn't stop myself," says Jimmy, and somewhat shamefaced, gives back the crayon to Parvana.
There's a plinging sound at Jimmy's pocket. He hauls out a cell phone as large as a full-grown man's hand and occupies himself with frenetically tapping the display.
"Whose is the cat?"
Patrick asks from the back.
"Uwe's kitty,"
the 3-year-old answers with rock-solid certainty.
"It is not," Uwe corrects her at once.
He sees Parvana smiling teasingly at him in the rearview mirror.
"Is so,"
she says.
"No, it isn't," says Uwe.
She laughs. Patrick looks very puzzled. She pats him encouragingly on the knee.
"Don't worry about what Uwe is saying. It's absolutely his cat."
"He's a bloody vagrant, that's what he is," Uwe corrects.
The cat lifts its head to find out what all the commotion is about, then concludes that all this is sensationally uninteresting and snuggles back into Parvana's lap, or rather, her belly.
"So it's not being handed in somewhere?"
Patrick wonders, scrutinizing the feline. The cat lifts its head a little, hissing briefly at him by way of an answer.
"What do you mean, handed in?" Uwe says, cutting him short.
"Well, to a cat home or some—" Patrick begins, but gets no further before Uwe bawls.
"No one's being handed into any bloody home!"
And with this, the subject is exhausted. Patrick tries not to look startled. Parvana tries not to burst out laughing. Neither really manages.
"Can't we just stop off somewhere for something to eat?"
Jimmy interjects and adjusts his seat position. The Saab starts swaying. Uwe looks at the group assembled around him as if he's been kidnapped and taken to a parallel universe. For a moment, he thinks about swerving off the road until he realizes that the worst-case scenario would be that they all accompanied him into the afterlife. After this insight, he reduces his speed and increases the gap significantly between his own car and the one in front.
"Whee!"
yells the 3-year-old.
"Can we stop, Uwe? Nazanin needs to pee,"
Parvana calls out, in that manner particular to people who believe that the back seat of a Saab is 200 yards behind the driver.
Yeah, then we can have something to eat at the same time, Jimmy nods with anticipation.
Yeah, let's do that. I need a wee as well, says Parvana.
McDonald's has toilets, Jimmy informs them helpfully.
McDonald's will be fine. Stop there, Parvana nods.
There'll be no stopping here, says Uva firmly.
Parvana eyes him in the rearview mirror. Uva glares back. 10 minutes later, he's sitting in the Saab waiting for them all outside McDonald's. Even the cat has gone inside with them. The traitor.
Parvana comes out and taps on Uva's window.
Are you sure you don't want anything? She says softly to him.
Uva nods. She looks a little dejected.
He rolls up the window again. She walks around the car and hops in on the passenger side.
Thanks for stopping, she smiles.
Yeah, says Uva.
She's eating French fries. Uva reaches forward and puts more newspaper on the floor in front of her. She starts laughing.
He can't understand at what?
I need your help, Uva,
she says suddenly. Uva doesn't seem spontaneously or enormously enthusiastic.
I thought you could help me pass my driving test, she continues.
What did you say?
Asks Uva, as if he must have heard her wrong. She shrugs.
Patrick will be in Cass for months. I have to get a driver's license so I can give the girls lifts. I thought you could give me some driving lessons.
Uva looks so confused that he even forgets to get upset. So in other words, you don't have a driver's license?
No.
So it wasn't a joke?
No.
Did you lose your license?
No, I never had one.
Uva's brain seems to need a good few moments to process this information, which, to him, is utterly beyond belief.
What's your job? He asks.
What's that got to do with it? She replies.
Surely it's got everything to do with it.
I'm a real estate agent.
Uva nods.
And no driver's license?
No.
Uva shakes his head, grimly, as if this is the very pinnacle of being a human being who doesn't take responsibility for anything. Parvana smiles that little teasing smile of hers again, scrunches up the empty French fries bag, and opens the door.
Look at it this way, Uva. Do you really want anyone else to teach me to drive in the residential area?
She gets out of the car and goes to the trash can. Uva doesn't answer, he just snorts. Jimmy shows up in the doorway.
Can I eat in the car?
He asks, a piece of chicken sticking out of his mouth.
At first, Uva thinks of saying no, but then realizes they'll never get out of here at this rate. Instead, he spreads so many newspapers over the passenger seat and floor that it's as if he's preparing to give the car a re-spray.
Just hop in, will you, so we can get home, he groans and gestures at Jimmy.
Jimmy nods, upbeat. His cell phone plings.
Stop that noise. This isn't a bloody pinball arcade.
Sorry, man. Work keeps emailing me all the time, says Jimmy,
balancing his food in one hand and fiddling with the phone in his pocket with the other.
So you have a job, then, says Uva.
Jimmy nods enthusiastically.
I program iPhone apps.
Uva has no further questions. At least it's relatively quiet in the car for 10 minutes until they roll into the parking area outside Uva's garage. Uva stops alongside the bicycle shed, puts the Saab into neutral without turning off the engine, and gives his passengers a meaningful look.
It's fine, Uva. Patrick can manage on his crutches from here, says Parvana with unmistakable irony.
Cars aren't allowed in the residential area, says Uva.
Undeterred, Patrick extricates himself and his cast from the back seat of the car while Jimmy squeezes out of the passenger seat, chicken grease all over his t-shirt. Parvana lifts out the 3-year-old in her car seat and puts it on the ground. The girl waves something in the air while yelling out some garbled words. Parvana nods, goes back to the car, leans in through the front door, and gives Uva a sheet of paper.
What's that?
Uva asks, making not the slightest movement to accept it.
It's Nazanin's drawing.
What am I supposed to do with that?
She's drawn you,
Parvana replies and shoves it into his hands. Uva gives the paper a reluctant look. It's filled with lines and swirls.
That's Jimmy, and that's the cat, and that's Patrick and me, and that's you, explains Parvana.
When she says that last bit, she points at a figure in the middle of the drawing. Everything else on the paper is drawn in black, but the figure in the middle is a veritable explosion of color, a riot of yellow and red and blue and green and orange and purple. "You're the funniest thing she knows. That's why she always draws you in color," says Parvana. Then she closes the passenger door and walks off. It takes several seconds before Uva collects himself enough to call out after her.
"What do you mean, always?"
But by then they have all started walking back to the houses. Slightly offended, Uva adjusts the newspaper on the passenger seat. The cat climbs over from the back and makes itself comfortable on it. Uva backs the Saab into the garage, closes the door, puts it into neutral without turning off the engine. Feels the exhaust fumes slowly filling the garage and gazes at the plastic tube hanging on the wall. For a few minutes, all that can be heard is the cat's breathing and the engine's rhythmic stuttering. It would be easy, just sitting there and waiting for the inevitable. It's the only logical thing, Uva knows. He's been longing for it for a long time now. The end. He misses her so much that sometimes he can't bear existing in his own body. It would be the only rational thing, just sitting here until the fumes lull both him and the cat to sleep and bring this to an end. But then he looks at the cat, and he turns off the engine. The next morning, they get up at 5:45, drink coffee, and eat tuna fish, respectively. When they finish their inspection round, Uva carefully shovels snow outside his house. When he's done with that, he stands outside his shed, leaning on his snow shovel, looking at the line of row houses. Then he crosses the road and starts clearing snow in front of the other houses. Chapter 25. A man called Uva and a piece of corrugated iron. Uva waits till after breakfast. Once he's let the cat out, only then does he take down a plastic bottle from the top shelf in the bathroom. He weighs it in his hand as if he's about to throw it somewhere, rattles it lightly to see if many pills are left. Towards the end, the doctors prescribed so many painkillers for Sonia. Their bathroom still looks like a storage facility for the Colombian mafia. Uva obviously doesn't trust medicine, has always been convinced its only real effects are psychological, and as a result, it only works on people with feeble brains. But it's only just struck him that chemicals are not at all an unusual way of taking one's life. He hears something outside the front door. The cat is back surprisingly quickly, scraping its paws by the threshold and sounding like it's been caught in a steel trap, as if it knows what's going through Uva's mind. Uva can understand that it's disappointed in him. He can't possibly expect it to understand his actions. He thinks about how it would feel, doing it this way. He has never taken any narcotics, has hardly even been affected by alcohol, has never liked the feeling of losing control. He's come to realize over the years that it's this very feeling that normal folk like and strive for, but as far as Uva is concerned, only a complete bloody airhead could find loss of control a state worth aiming for. He wonders if he'll feel nauseated, if he'll feel pain when his body's organs give up and stop functioning. Or will he just go to sleep when his body becomes unfit for use? By now, the cat is howling out there in the snow. Uva closes his eyes and thinks of Sonia. It's not that he's the sort of man who gives up and dies. He doesn't want her to think that. But it's actually wrong, all this. She married him, and now he doesn't quite know how to carry on without the tip of her nose and the pit between his throat and his shoulder. That's all. He unscrews the lid and distributes the pills along the edge of the wash basin, watches them as if expecting them to transform into little murderous robots. Of course they don't. Uva is unimpressed. He finds it quite inexplicable how those little white dots could do him any harm, regardless of how many of them he takes. The cat sounds as if it's spitting snow all over Uva's front door. But then it's interrupted by another, quite different sound. A dog barking. Uva looks up. It's quiet for a few seconds. And then he hears the cat yowling with pain, then more barking, and blonde weed roaring something. Uva stands there gripping the wash basin, closes his eyes as if he could blink the sound out.
It doesn't work. Then, at last, he sighs and straightens up, unscrews the lid of the bottle, pushes the pills back into it, goes down the stairs. As he crosses the living room, he puts the jar on the windowsill. And through the window, he sees blonde weed in the road, taking aim and then rushing towards the cat. Uva opens the door exactly as she's about to kick the animal in the head with all her strength. The cat quickly dodges her needle-sharp heel and backs away towards Uva's tool shed. Mutt growls hysterically, saliva flying around its head as if it were a rabies-infected beast. There's fur in its jaws. This is the first time Uva can remember having seen weed without her sunglasses. Malevolence glitters in her green eyes. She pulls back, preparing for another kick, then catches sight of Uva and stops herself mid-flow. Her lower lip is trembling with anger. "I'll have that thing shot," she hisses and points at the cat. Very slowly, Uva shakes his head without taking his eyes off her. She swallows. Something about his expression, as if sculpted from a seam of rock, makes her murderous assurance falter. "It's a fucking street cat, and it's gonna die. It's scratched prints," she stammers. Uva doesn't say anything, but his eyes turn black, and in the end, even the dog backs away from him. "Come on, Prince," she says, disappearing around the corner as if Uva had physically shoved her from behind. Uva stays where he is, breathing heavily. He presses his fist to his chest, feels the uncontrolled beating of his heart. He groans a little, then he looks at the cat. The cat looks back at him. There's a new wound down its flank. Blood in its fur again.
"Nine lives won't last you very long, will they?" says Uva.
The cat licks its paw and looks as if it's not the sort of cat that likes to keep count. Uva nods and steps aside.
"Get inside, then."
The cat traipses in over the threshold. Uva closes the door. He stands in the middle of the living room. Everywhere, Sonia looks back at him. Only now does it strike him that he's positioned the photographs so they follow him through the house wherever he goes. She's on the table in the kitchen, hangs on the wall in the hall and halfway up the stairs. She's on the window shelf in the living room where the cat has now jumped up and sits right beside her. It sends Uva a disgruntled look as it sweeps the pills onto the floor with a crash. When Uva picks up the bottle, the cat looks at him in horror, as if to shout, "J'accuse!" Uva kicks a little at a baseboard, then turns around and goes into the kitchen to put the pill bottle in a cupboard. Then he makes coffee and pours water in a bowl for the cat. They drink in silence. Uva picks up the empty bowl and puts it next to his coffee cup in the sink. He stands with his hands on his hips for a good while, then turns around and goes into the hall.
"Tag along, then," he urges the cat without looking at it. "Let's give that village cur something to think about."
Uva puts on the navy winter jacket, steps into his clogs, and lets the cat walk out the door first. He looks at the photo of Sonia on the wall. She laughs back at him. "Maybe it's not so enormously important to die that it can't wait another hour," thinks Uva, and follows the cat into the street. He goes to Rune's house, where it takes several minutes before the door opens. There's a slow, dragging sound inside before anything happens with the lock, as if a ghost is approaching with heavy chains rattling behind it. Then, finally, it opens, and Rune stands there looking at Uva and the cat with an empty stare.
"Got any corrugated iron?" wonders Uva, without allowing any time for small talk.
Rune gives him a concentrated stare for a second or two, as if his brain is fighting desperately to produce a memory.
"Corrugated iron," he says to himself, as if tasting the word, like someone who's just woken up and is intensely trying to remember what he's been dreaming. "Corrugated iron, that's it," says Uva with a nod.
Rune looks at him, or rather he looks straight through him. His eyes have the gleam of a newly waxed car hood. He's emaciated and hunchbacked. His beard is gray, bordering on white. This used to be a solid bloke, commanding a bit of respect, but now his clothes hang on his body in rags. He's grown old, very, very old, Uva realizes, and it hits him with a force he hadn't quite counted on.
Rune's gaze flickers for a moment. Then his mouth starts twitching.
Uva?
He exclaims.
Yeah, well, one thing's for sure. I'm not the Pope, Uva replies.
The baggy skin on Rune's face cracks into a sleepy smile. Both men, once as close as men of that sort could be, stare at each other. One of them, a man who refuses to forget the past, and one who can't remember it at all.
You look old, says Uva.
Rune grins. Then Anita's anxious voice makes itself heard, and in the next moment, her small drumming feet are bearing her at speed towards the door.
Is there someone at the door, Rune? What are you doing there?
She calls out, terrified as she appears in the doorway. Then she sees Uva.
Oh, hello, Uva,
she says and stops abruptly. Uva stands there with his hands in his pockets. The cat beside him looks as if it would do the same if it had pockets or hands. Anita is small and colorless in her gray trousers, gray knitted cardigan, gray hair, and gray skin, but Uva notices that her face is slightly red-eyed and swollen. Quickly, she wipes her eyes and blinks away the pain, as women of that generation do, as if they stood in the doorway every morning, determinedly driving sorrow out of the house with a broom. Tenderly, she takes Rune by the shoulders and leads him to his wheelchair by the window in the living room.
Hello, Uva, she repeats in a friendly, also surprised voice when she comes back to the door. What can I do for you?
Do you have any corrugated iron? He asks back.
She looks puzzled.
Corrected iron? She mumbles,
as if the iron has somehow been wrong and now someone has to put it right. Uva sighs deeply.
Good God, corrugated iron.
Anita doesn't look the slightest bit less puzzled. Am I supposed to have some?
Rune will have some in his shed, definitely, says Uva and holds out his hand.
Anita nods, takes down the shed key from the wall and puts it in Uva's hand.
Corrugated? Iron? She says again.
Yes, says Uva.
But we don't have a metal roof.
What's that got to do with it?
Anita shakes her head.
No, maybe it doesn't, of course.
One always has a bit of sheet metal, says Uva, as if this was absolutely beyond dispute.
Anita nods, as one does when faced with the undeniable fact that a bit of corrugated iron is the sort of thing that all normal, right-thinking people keep lying about in their sheds just in case there's call for it.
But don't you have any of that metal yourself, then?
She tries mainly to have something to talk about.
I've used mine up, says Uva.
Anita nods understandingly. As one does when facing the indisputable fact that there's nothing odd about a normal man without a metal roof getting through his corrugated iron at such a rate that it runs out. A minute later, Uva turns up triumphantly in the doorway, dragging a gigantic piece of corrugated iron as big as a living room rug. Anita honestly has no idea how such a large piece of metal has even fitted in there without her knowing about it.
Told you, Uva says with a nod, giving her back the key.
Yes, you did, didn't you?
Anita feels obliged to admit. Uva turns to the window. Rune looks back. And just as Anita turns around to go back into the house, Rune grins again and lifts his hand in a brief wave. As if right there, just for a second, he knew exactly who Uva was and what he was doing there. Anita stops hesitantly, turns around.
They've been here from social services again. They want to take Rune away from me, she says without looking up.
Her voice cracks like dry newspaper when she speaks her husband's name. Uva fingers the corrugated iron.
They say I'm not capable of taking care of him, with his illness and everything. They say he has to go into a home, she says.
Uva continues fingering the corrugated iron.
He'll die if I put him in a home, Uva, you know that, she whispers.
Uva nods and looks at the remains of a cigarette butt, frozen in the crack between two paving stones. Out of the corner of his eye, he notices how Anita is sort of leaning slightly to one side. Sonia explained about a year ago that it was the hip replacement operation, he remembers. Her hands shake as well these days. The first stage of multiple sclerosis, Sonia had also explained, and a few years ago Rune got Alzheimer's as well.
Your lad can come and give you a hand then, he mumbles in a low voice.
Anita looks up, looks into his eyes and smiles indulgently.
Johan? He lives in America, you know. He's got enough on his own plate. You know how young people are.
Uwe doesn't answer. Anita says America as if it were the kingdom of heaven where her egotistical son has moved. Not once has Uwe seen that brat here on the street since Rune sickened. Grown man now, but no time for his parents. Anita jumps to attention as if she's caught herself doing something disreputable. She smiles apologetically at Uwe.
Sorry, Uwe, I shouldn't stand here taking up your time with my nattering.
She goes back into the house. Uwe stays where he is with the sheet of corrugated iron in his hand and the cat at his side. He mutters something to himself just before the door is closed. Anita turns around in surprise, peers out of the crack, and looks at him.
Pardon me?
Uwe twists without meeting her eyes. Then he turns and starts to leave, while his words slip out of him involuntarily.
I said if you have any more problems with those bloody radiators, you can come and ring my doorbell. The cat and me are at home.
Anita's furrowed face pulls itself into a surprised smile. She takes half a step out the door as if she wants to say something more. Maybe something about Sonia, how deeply she misses her best friend. How she misses what they had, all four of them, when they first moved onto this street almost 40 years ago. How she even misses the way Rune and Uwe used to argue. But Uwe has already disappeared around the corner. Back in his tool shed, Uwe fetches the spare battery for the Saab and two large metal clips. He lays out the sheet of corrugated iron across the paving stones between the shed and the house and carefully covers it with snow. He stands next to the cat, evaluating his creation for a long time. A perfect dog trap, hidden under snow, bursting with electricity, ready to bite. It seems a wholly proportionate revenge. The next time Blonde Weed passes by with that bloody mud of hers and the latter gets the idea of peeing on Uva's paving, it'll do so onto an electrified, conductive metal plate. And then let's see how amusing they find it, Uwe thinks to himself. The cat tilts its head and looks at the metal sheet.
Like a bolt of lightning up your urethra, says Uwe.
The cat looks at him for a long time as if to say, you're not serious, are you? Eventually, Uwe sticks his hands in his pockets and shakes his head.
No, I suppose not, he sighs glumly.
And then he packs up the battery and clamps and corrugated iron and puts everything in the garage. Not because he doesn't think those morons deserve a proper electric shock, because they do, but because he knows it's been a while since someone reminded him of the difference between being wicked because one has to be or because one can.
It's a bloody good idea, though, he concludes to the cat as they go back into the house.
The cat goes into the living room and the dismissive body language of someone mumbling, sure it was. And then they have lunch. Chapter 26. A man called Uwe and a society where no one can repair a bicycle anymore. Many people find it difficult living with someone who likes to be alone. It grates on those who can't handle it themselves. But Sonia didn't whine more than she had to. I took you as you were, she used to say. But Sonia was not so silly that she didn't understand that even men like Uwe liked to have someone to talk to now and then. It had been quite a while since he'd had that.
I won, Uwe says curtly when he hears the slamming of the mailbox.
The cat jumps off the windowsill in the living room and goes into the kitchen. Bad loser, thinks Uwe, and goes to the front door. It's been years since he last made a bet with someone about what time the mail would come. He used to make bets with Rune when they were on vacation in the summers, which grew so intensive that they developed complex systems of marginal extensions and half-minutes to determine who was most accurate. That was how it was back in those days. The mail arrived at 12 o'clock on the dot, so one needed precise demarcations to be able to say who had guessed right.
Nowadays, it isn't like that. Nowadays, the mail can be delivered halfway through the afternoon, any old way it pleases. The post office takes care of it when it feels like it, and you just have to be grateful and that's it. Uwe tried to make bets with Sonia after he and Rune stopped talking, but she didn't understand the rules, so he gave up. The youth barely manages to avoid being knocked off the steps when Uwe throws the door open. Uwe looks at him in surprise. He's wearing a postman's uniform.
Yes, demands Uwe.
The youth looks like he can't come up with an answer. He fiddles with a newspaper and a letter. And that's when Uwe notices that it's the same youth who argued with him about that bicycle a few days ago, by the storage shed. The bicycle the youth said he was going to fix. Of course, Uwe knows what that means. Fix means steal and sell on the internet to these rascals. That's the long and short of it. The youth looks, if possible, even less thrilled about recognizing Uwe than vice versa. He looks a little like a waiter sometimes does, when he's undecided about whether to serve you your food or take it into the kitchen and spit on it. The lad looks coolly at Uwe before reluctantly handing the mail over with a grumpy, "There you go." Uwe accepts it without taking his eyes off him. "Your mailbox is smashed, so I was going to give you these," says the youth. He nods at the folded double pile of junk that used to be Uva's mailbox until the lanky one, who can't back up with a trailer, backed his trailer into it, then nods at the letter and newspaper in Uva's hand. Uwe looks down at them. The newspaper is one of those local rags they hand out for nothing, even when one puts up a sign quite expressly telling them to do no such bloody thing. And the letter is most likely advertising, Uwe imagines. Admittedly, his name and address have been written in longhand on the front, but that's a typical advertising trick, to make one think it's a letter from a real person, and then one opens it, and in a flash, one has been subjected to marketing. That trick won't work on Uwe. The youth stands there, rocking on his heels and looking down at the ground, as if he's struggling with something inside that wants to come out.
Is there something else? Uwe wonders.
The youth pulls his hand through his greasy, late pubescent shock of hair. "Ah, what the hell. I was just wondering if you have a wife called Sonia," he manages to say. Uwe looks suspicious. The lad points at the envelope. "I saw the surname. I had a teacher with that name. Was just wondering." He seems to be cursing himself for having said anything. He spins around on the spot and starts walking away. Uwe clears his throat and kicks the threshold.
"Wait. That could be right. What about Sonia?"
The lad stops a yard farther away.
"Ah, shit. I just liked her, that's all I wanted to say. I'm not so good at reading and writing and all that."
Uwe almost says, "I'd never have guessed." But he leaves it. The youth twists awkwardly, runs his hand through his hair, somewhat disoriented as if he's hoping to find the appropriate words up there somewhere. "She's the only teacher I ever had who didn't think I was thick as a plank," he mumbles, almost choking on his emotion. "She got me reading that Shakespeare, you know? I didn't know I could even read, sort of thing. She got me reading the most hardcore thick book and all. It felt really shit when I heard she died, you know?"
Uwe doesn't answer. The youth looks down at the ground, shrugs.
"That's it."
He's silent.
And then they both stand there, the 59-year-old and the teenager, a few yards apart, kicking at the snow, as if they were kicking a memory back and forth, a memory of a woman who insisted on seeing more potential in certain men than they saw in themselves. Neither of them knows what to do with their shared experience.
"What are you doing with that bike?" says Uwe at last.
"I promised to fix it up for my girlfriend. She lives there," the youth answers, nodding at the house at the far end of their row, opposite Anita and Rune's place, the one where those recycling types live when they're not in Thailand or wherever they go. "Or, you know, she's not my girlfriend yet, but I'm thinking I'm wanting her to be, sort of thing."
Uwe scrutinizes the youth as middle-aged men often scrutinize younger men who seem to invent their own grammar as they go along.
"So have you got any tools then?" he asks.
The youth shakes his head.
"How are you going to repair a bike without tools?"
Uwe marvels, more with genuine surprise than agitation.
The youth shrugs. "Dunno."
Why'd you promise to repair it, then?
The youth kicks the snow, scratches his face with his entire hand, embarrassed.
Because I love her.
Uwe can't quite decide what to say to that one, so he rolls up the local newspaper and envelope and slaps it into his palm like a baton.
I have to get going, the youth mumbles almost inaudibly, and makes a movement to turn around again.
Come over after work, then, and I'll get the bike out for you.
Uwe's words seem to pop up out of nowhere.
But you have to bring your own tools, he adds.
The youth brightens up.
You serious, man?
Uwe continues, slapping the paper baton into his hand. The youth swallows.
Awesome! Wait, shit, I can't pick it up today, I have to go to my other job, but tomorrow, man, I can come tomorrow. Is it cool if I pick it up tomorrow, like, instead?
Uwe tilts his head and looks as if everything that's just been said came from the mouth of a character in an animated film. The youth takes a deep breath and pulls himself together.
What other job?
Asks Uwe, as if he's had an incomplete answer in the final of Jeopardy.
I sort of work in a cafe in the evenings and at the weekends, says the youth,
with that new one hope in his eyes about perhaps being able to rescue his fantasy relationship with a girlfriend who doesn't even know that she's his girlfriend, the sort of relationship that only a boy in late puberty with greasy hair can have.
I need both jobs because I'm saving money, he explains.
For what?
A car.
Uwe can't avoid noticing how he straightens up slightly when he says, car. Uwe looks dubious for a moment. Then he slowly but watchfully slaps the baton into his palm again.
What sort of car?
I had a look at a Renault,
the youth says brightly, stretching a little more. The air around the two men stops for a hundredth of a breath or so. An eerie silence suddenly envelops them. If this were a scene from a film, the camera would very likely have time to pan 360 degrees around them before Uwe finally loses his composure.
Renault? Renault? That's bloody French! You can't bloody well go and buy a French car!
The youth seems just about to say something, but he doesn't get the chance before Uwe shakes his whole upper body as if trying to get rid of a persistent wasp.
Christ, you puppy! Don't you know anything about cars?
The youth shakes his head. Uwe sighs deeply and puts his hand on his forehead, as if he's been struck by a sudden migraine.
And how are you going to get the bicycle to the cafe if you don't have a car?
He says at long last, visibly struggling to regain his composure.
I hadn't thought about that, says the youth.
Uwe shakes his head.
Renault! Christ almighty!
The youth nods. Uwe rubs his eyes in frustration.
Where's the sodden cafe you work at, then? He mutters.
20 minutes later, Parvana opens her front door in surprise. Uwe is standing outside, thoughtfully striking his hand with a paper baton.
Have you got one of those green signs?
What?
You have to have one of those green signs when you're a student driver. Do you have one or not?
She nods.
Yeah, yes, I have, but what...
I'll come and pick you up in 2 hours. We'll take my car.
Uwe turns around and tramps back across the little road without waiting for an answer. Chapter 27. A Man Called Uwe and a Driving Lesson. It happened now and then in the almost 40 years they lived in the row of row houses that some thoughtless and recently moved-in neighbor was bold enough to ask Sonia what the real cause was for the deep animosity between Uwe and Rune. Why had two men who had once been friends suddenly started hating one another with such overpowering intensity? Sonia usually answered that it was quite straightforward. It was simply about how when the two men and their wives moved into their houses, Uwe drove a Saab 96 and Rune a Volvo 244. A year or so later, Uwe bought a Saab 95 and Rune bought a Volvo 245. 3 years later, Uwe bought a Saab 900 and Rune bought a Volvo 265. In the decades that followed, Uwe bought another two Saab 900s and then a Saab 9000. Rune bought another Volvo 265 and then a Volvo 745. But a few years later, he went back to a sedan model and acquired a Volvo 740. Whereupon Uwe bought yet one more Saab 9000, and Rune eventually went over to a Volvo 760, After which Uva got himself a Saab 9000i and Rune part exchanged to a Volvo 760 Turbo. And then the day came when Uva went to the car dealer to look at the recently launched Saab 9-3. And when he came home in the evening, Rune had bought a BMW.
A BMW, Uva had roared at Sonia. How can you reason with a human being like that? How?
And possibly it was not the entire explanation for why these two men loathed one another, Sonia used to explain. Either you understood it, or you didn't. And if you didn't understand, there was no point even trying to clarify the rest.
Most people never did understand, Uva often commented. But then people had no idea of loyalty these days. The car was just a means of transport, and the road just a complication arising between two points.
Uva is convinced. This is why the roads are as bad as they are. If people were a little more careful with their cars, they wouldn't drive like idiots, he thinks, watching with concern as Parvana pushes away the newspaper he has spread across her seat. She has to retract the driver's seat as far as it'll go, so she can maneuver her pregnant belly into the car, then bring it forward all the way so she can reach the wheel. The driving lesson doesn't start so well. Or to be precise, it begins with Parvana trying to get into the Saab with a bottle of carbonated juice in her hand. She shouldn't have done that. Then she tries to fiddle with Uva's radio to find a more entertaining station. She shouldn't have done that either. Uva picks up the newspaper from the floor, rolls it up, and starts nervously striking it against his hand, like a more aggressive version of a stress ball. She grabs the wheel and looks at the instruments like a curious child.
Where do we start?
She yells eagerly, after at long last agreeing to hand over the juice. Uva sighs. The cat sits in the back seat and looks as if it wished, with intensity, that cats knew how to strap on safety belts.
Press the clutch pedal, says Uva, slightly grim.
Parvana looks around her seat as if searching for something. Then she looks at Uva and smiles ingratiatingly.
Which one's the clutch?
Uva's face fills with disbelief. She looks around the seat again, turns toward the seatbelt fixture in the backrest, as if she may find the clutch there. Uva holds his forehead. Parvana's facial expression immediately sours.
I told you I want a driver's license for an automatic. Why did you make me use your car?
Because you're getting a proper license.
Uva cuts her short, emphasizing proper in a way that makes it plain that a license for an automatic is as much a proper driver's license as a car with an automatic gearbox is a proper car.
Stop shouting at me, shouts Parvana.
I'm not shouting, Uva shouts back.
The cat curls up in the back seat, clearly anxious not to end up in the middle of this, whatever it is. Parvana crosses her arms and glares out of the side window. Uva strikes his paper baton rhythmically into the palm of his hand.
The pedal on the far left is the clutch, he grunts in the end.
After taking a breath so deep that he has to stop halfway for a rest before he inhales again, he continues.
The one in the middle is the brake. On the far right is the accelerator. You release the clutch slowly until you find the point where it engages. Then give it a bit of gas, release the clutch, and move off.
Parvana seems to accept this as an apology. She nods and calms down, takes hold of the steering wheel, starts the car, and follows his instructions. The Saab lurches forward with a little jump, then pauses before catapulting itself with a loud roar towards the guest parking, and very nearly crashing into another car. Uva tugs at the handbrake. Parvana lets go of the steering wheel and yells in panic, covering her eyes with her hands until the Saab finally comes to an abrupt stop. Uva is puffing as if he'd had to make his way to the handbrake by forcing himself through a military obstacle course. His facial muscles twitch like a man whose eyes are being sprayed with lemon juice.
What do I do now?
Roars Parvana when she realizes that the Saab is an inch from the taillights of the car in front.
Reverse! You put it in reverse!
Uva manages to say through his teeth.
I almost smashed into that car, pants Parvana.
Uva peers over the edge of the hood. And then, suddenly, a sort of calm comes over his face. He turns and nods at her, very matter of fact.
Doesn't matter. It's a Volvo.
It takes them 15 minutes to get out of the parking area and onto the main road. Once they're there, Parvana revs the first gear until the Saab vibrates like it's about to explode. Uwe tells her to change gear, and she replies that she doesn't know how. Meanwhile, the cat seems to be trying to open the back door. When they get to the first red light, a big black SUV with two shaven-headed young men in the front pulls up so close to their rear bumper that Uwe is pretty sure he'll have their license number etched into his paintwork when they get home. Parvana glances nervously in the mirror. The SUV revs its engine as if giving vent to some sort of opinion. Uwe turns and looks out the back window. The two men have tattoos all over their throats, he notes, as if the SUV is not a clear enough advertisement for their stupidity. The light turns green. Parvana brings up the clutch. The Saab splutters and the instrument panel goes black. Stressed, Parvana turns the key in the ignition, which only makes it grind in a heart-rending manner. The engine makes a roar, coughs, and dies anew. The men with the shaved heads and tattooed throats sound the horn. One of them gestures.
Press down the clutch and give it more gas, says Uwe.
That's what I'm doing, she answers.
That's not what you're doing.
Yes, I am.
Now you're shouting.
I'm not bloody shouting, she shouts.
The SUV blares its horn. Parvana presses down the clutch. The Saab rolls backwards a few inches and bumps into the front of the SUV. The throat tattoos are now hanging on the horn as if it's an air raid alarm. Parvana tugs despairingly at the key, only to be rewarded by yet another stall. Then, suddenly, she lets go of everything and hides her face in her hands.
Good God, are you crying now?
Uwe asks in amazement.
I'm not bloody crying,
she howls, her tears spattering all over the dashboard. Uwe leans back and looks down at his knee, fingers the end of the paper baton.
It's just such a strain, this, do you understand?
She sobs and leans her forehead against the wheel as if hoping it might be soft and fluffy.
I'm sort of pregnant. I'm just a bit stressed. Can no one show a bit of understanding for a pregnant bloody woman who's a bit stressed?
Uwe twists uncomfortably in the passenger seat. She punches the steering wheel several times, mumbles something about how all she wants to do is drink some bloody lemonade, flops her arms over the top of the steering wheel, buries her face in her sleeves, and starts crying again. The SUV behind them honks until it sounds as if the Finland ferry is about to run them down. And then something in Uwe snaps. He throws the door open, gets out of the car, walks slowly around the SUV, and rips the driver's door open.
Have you never been a student driver or what?
The driver doesn't have time to answer.
You stupid little bastard!
Uwe roars in the face of the shaven-headed young man with throat tattoos, his spittle cascading over their seats. The throat tattoo doesn't have time to answer, and Uwe doesn't wait for him either. Instead, he grabs the young man by his collar and pulls him up so hard that his body tumbles clumsily out of the car. He's a muscular sort, easily weighing in at 200 pounds, but Uwe holds his collar in an immovable steel grip. Evidently, throat tattoo is so surprised by the strength in the old man's grip that it doesn't occur to him to put up any resistance. Fury burns in Uva's eyes as he presses the probably 35 years younger man so hard against the side of the SUV that the bodywork creaks. He places the tip of his index finger in the middle of the shaved head and positions his eyes so close to throat tattoo's face that they feel each other's breath.
If you sound that horn one more time, it'll be the last thing you do on this earth, got it?
Throat tattoo allows his eyes to divert quickly towards his equally muscular friend inside the car, and then at the growing line of other cars behind the SUV. No one is making the slightest move to come to his assistance. No one beeps. No one moves. Everyone seems to be thinking the same thing. If a non-throat tattooed man of Uwe's age without any hesitation steps up to a throat tattooed man of the age of this throat tattoo and presses him up against a car in this manner, then it's very likely not the throat tattooed man one should be most worried about annoying. Uwe's eyes are black with anger. After a short moment of reflection, throat tattoo seems convinced by the argument that the old man unmistakably means business. The tip of his nose almost unnoticeably moves up and down. Uwe nods by way of confirmation and lets him back down on the ground. Then turns around, walks around the SUV, and gets back into the Saab. Parvana stares at him with her mouth hanging open.
"Now, you listen to me," says Uwe calmly while he carefully closes the door. "You've given birth to 2 children, and quite soon you'll be squeezing out a third. You've come here from a land far away, and most likely you fled war and persecution and all sorts of other nonsense. You've learned a new language and got yourself an education, and you're holding together a family of obvious incompetence. And I'll be damned if I've seen you afraid of a single bloody thing in this world before now."
Uwe rivets his eyes into her. Parvana is still agape. Uwe points imperiously at the pedals under her feet.
"I'm not asking for brain surgery. I'm asking you to drive a car. It's got an accelerator, a brake, and a clutch. Some of the greatest twits in world history have sorted out how it works, and you will as well."
And then he utters 7 words, which Parvana will always remember as the loveliest compliment he'll ever give her.
"Because you are not a complete twit."
Parvana pushes a ringlet of hair out of her face, sticky with tears. Clumsily, she once again grabs hold of the steering wheel with both hands. Uwe nods, puts on his safety belt, and makes himself comfortable.
"Now, push the clutch down, and do what I say."
And that afternoon, Parvana learns to drive. Chapter 28. A man who was Uwe, and a man who was Rune. Sonia used to say that Uwe was unforgiving. For instance, he refused to go back to the local bakery, 8 years after they gave him the wrong change when he bought pastries once at the end of the 1990s. Uwe called it having firm principles. They were never quite in agreement when it came to words and their meanings. He knows that she is disappointed that he and Rune could not keep the peace. He knows that the animosity between him and Rune, to some extent, ruined the possibility of Sonia and Anita becoming the great friends they could have been. But when a conflict has been going on for long enough, it can be impossible to sort out, for the simple reason that no one can remember how it first started. And Uwe didn't know how it first started. He only knew how it ended. A BMW. There must have been some people who understood it and some who didn't. There were probably people who thought there was no connection between cars and emotions. But there would never be a clearer explanation as to why these 2 men had become enemies for life. Of course, it had started innocently enough, not long after Uwe and Sonia came back from Spain and the accident. Uwe laid new paving stones in their little garden that summer, whereupon Rune put up a new fence around his, whereupon Uwe put up an even higher fence around his garden, whereupon Rune went off to the building supply store and a few days later started boasting all over the street that he had built a swimming pool. "That was no bloody swimming pool," Uwe raged to Sonia. "It was a little splash pool for Rune and Anita's newborn urchin. That was all it was." For a while, Uwe had plans to report it to the planning department as an illegal construction. But at that point, Sonia put her foot down and sent him out to mow the lawn and calm himself down. And so Uwe did just that, although it certainly did not calm him down very much at all. The lawn was oblong, about 5 yards wide, and ran along the backs of Uwe's and Rune's houses, and the house in between, which Sonia and Anita had quickly named the neutral zone. No one quite knew what that lawn was for or what function it was expected to fill. But when row housing was put up in those days, some city architect must have got the idea that there had to be lawns here and there for no other reason than that they looked so very nice in the drawings. When Uwe and Rune formed the Residents Association and were still friends, the 2 men decided that Uwe should be the groundsman and responsible for keeping the grass mowed. It had always been Uwe before. On one occasion, the other neighbors had proposed that the association should put out tables and benches on the lawn to create a sort of common space for all the neighbors. But obviously, Uwe and Rune put a stop to that at once. It would only turn into a bloody mess and lots of noise. And as far as that went, it was all peace and joy. At least insofar as anything could be peace and joy when men like Uwe and Rune were involved. Soon after Rune had built his pool,
a rat ran across Uva's newly mown lawn and into the trees on the other side. Uva immediately called a crisis meeting of the association and demanded that all local residents put out rat poison around their houses. The neighbors protested, of course, because they had seen hedgehogs by the edge of the woods and were concerned that they might eat the poison. Rune also protested because he was afraid that some of it would end up in his pool. Uva suggested to Rune that he button up his shirt and go see a psychologist about his delusions of living on the French Riviera. Rune made a malicious joke at Uva's expense, to the effect that Uva had probably only imagined seeing that rat. All the others laughed. Uva never forgave Rune for that. The next morning, someone had thrown birdseed all over Rune's outside space, and Rune had to use a spade to chase away a dozen rats as big as vacuum cleaners in the next few weeks. After that, Uva got permission to put out poison, even though Rune mumbled that he'd pay him back for this. 2 years later, Rune won the great tree conflict when he gained permission at the annual meeting to saw down a tree blocking his and Anita's evening sun on one side. The same tree on the other side screened off Uva and Sonia's bedroom from blinding morning sunlight. Further, he managed to block Uva's furious motion that the association would then have to pay for Uva's new awning. However, Uva got his revenge during the snow clearance skirmish of the following winter, in which Rune wanted to anoint himself chief of snow shoveling, and at the same time lumber the residents' association with the purchase of a gigantic snowblower. Uva had no intention of letting Rune walk around with some bloody contraption at the expense of the association and spray snow over Uva's windows, which he made crystal clear at the steering group meeting. Rune was still chosen to be responsible for snow clearance, but to his great annoyance, he had to spend all winter shoveling the snow by hand between the houses. The outcome of this, of course, was that he consistently shoveled outside all the houses in their row except Uva and Sonia's. Just to annoy Rune, in mid-January, Uva hired a gigantic snowblower to clear the 10 square yards outside his door. Rune was incandescent about it, Uva remembers with delight to this day. Of course, Rune found a way of paying it back the following summer by buying one of those monstrous lawn tractors. Then, by a combination of treachery, lies, and conspiracies, he managed to get approval at the annual meeting to take over Uva's lawn mowing responsibilities, on the grounds that he had slightly more adequate equipment than the one who was in charge of it before. As a partial restitution, Uva managed some 4 years later to stop Rune's plans of putting in new windows in his house, because after 33 letters and a dozen angry telephone calls, the planning department gave up and accepted Uva's argument that this would ruin the harmonious architectural character of the area. In the following 3 years, Rune refused to speak of Uva as anything but that bloody red tapist. Uva took it as a compliment. And the next year, he changed his own windows. When the next winter set in, the steering group decided that the area needed a new collective heating system. Quite coincidentally, of course, Rune and Uva happened to have diametrically different views of what sort of heating system was required, which was jokingly referred to by the other neighbors as the Battle of the Water Pump. It grew into an eternal struggle between the two men. And so it continued. But as Sonia used to say, there were also some other moments. There weren't many of them, but women like Sonia and Anita knew how to make the most of them. Because there hadn't always been burning conflict. One summer in the 1980s, for instance, Uva had bought a Saab 9000 and Rune a Volvo 760. And they were so pleased with this that they kept the peace for several weeks. Sonia and Anita even managed to get all four of them together for dinner on a few occasions. Rune and Anita's son, who'd had time to turn into a teenager by this stage, with all the divinely sanctioned charmlessness and impoliteness this entailed, sat at one end of the table like an irritable accessory. That boy was born angry, Sonia used to say with sadness in her voice. But Uva and Rune managed to get along so well that they even had a little whiskey together at the end of the evening. Unfortunately, at their last dinner that summer, Uva and Rune had the idea of having a barbecue, and obviously they started feuding at once about the most effective way of lighting Uva's globe grill. Within 15 minutes, the argument had escalated so much in volume that Sonia and Anita agreed it might be best to eat their dinner separately after all. The two men had time to buy and sell
a Volvo 760 Turbo and a Saab 9000i before they spoke to one another again. Meanwhile, the neighbors came and went in the row of houses. In the end, there had been so many new faces in the doorways of the other row houses that they all merged in a sea of gray. Where before there had been forest, there were only construction cranes. Uwe and Rune stood outside their houses, hands obstinately shoved into their trouser pockets like ancient relics in a new age. While a parade of uppity real estate agents barely able to see over their grapefruit size tie knots patrolled the little row between the houses and kept their eyes on them, like vultures watching aging water buffaloes. They could hardly wait to move some bloody consultant's families into their houses. Both Uwe and Rune knew that very well. Rune and Anita's son moved away from home when he was 20 in the early 1990s. Apparently he went to America, Uwe found out from Sonia. They hardly saw him again. From time to time, Anita had a telephone call around the time of Christmas, but he was so busy with his own things now, as Anita said when she tried to keep her spirits up, even though Sonia could see that she had to hold back her tears. Some boys leave everything behind and never look back. That was all there was to it. Rune never said anything about it, but to anyone who had known him a long time, it was as if he shrank a couple of inches in the years that followed, as if he sort of crumpled with a deep sigh and never really breathed properly again. A few years later, Rune and Uwe fell out for the 100th time about that collective heating system. Uwe stormed out of a residents' association meeting in a fury and never returned. The last battle the two men fought was a bit into the noughties when Rune bought one of those automated robotic lawnmowers, which he'd ordered from Asia, and left it to whiz about on the lawn behind the houses. Rune could even remotely program it to cut special patterns, Sonia said in an impressed tone of voice one evening when she came home from visiting Anita. Uwe soon caught on that this special pattern was the habit of that robotic little shit to consistently rumble back and forth all night outside Uwe and Sonia's bedroom window. One evening, Sonia saw Uwe fetch a screwdriver and walk out the veranda door. Next morning, the little robot, quite inexplicably, had driven right into Rune's pool. The month after, Rune went into the hospital for the first time. He never bought another lawnmower. Uwe did not know himself how their animosity had begun, though he knew very well that it ended there and then. Afterwards, it was only memories for Uwe, and a lack of them for Rune. And there were very likely people who thought one could not interpret men's feelings by the cars they drove. But when they moved onto the street, Uwe drove a Saab 96 and Rune a Volvo 244. After the accident, Uwe bought a Saab 95 so he'd have space for Sonia's wheelchair. That same year, Rune bought a Volvo 245 to have space for a stroller. 3 years later, Sonia got a more modern wheelchair and Uwe bought a hatchback, a Saab 900. Rune bought a Volvo 265 because Anita had started talking about having another child. Then Uwe bought two more Saab 900s, and after that, his first Saab 9000. Rune bought a Volvo 265, and eventually a Volvo 745 station wagon. But no more children came. One evening, Sonia came home and told Uwe that Anita had been to the doctor. And a week later, a Volvo 740 stood parked in Rune's garage, the sedan model. Uwe saw it when he washed his Saab. In the evening, Rune found a half bottle of whiskey outside his door. They never spoke about it. Maybe their sorrow over children that never came should have brought the two men closer. But sorrow is unreliable in that way. When people don't